it has a great impact, even when you see someone is I was going to say something else, like even in the villages of the countryside, like the young people are not really young people, like people start to make like small communities or committees to organize the curfew, and to go, it's not only to organize, to tell people like, hey, don't leave the house. It's also they help people if they need something, like if someone like run out of let's say rice or bread, they call this committee, this group, and this group brings them the bread. So they tell them like, we can do anything you want, just stay at home. And after they do like shift all the day.
Wow. And so those committees are functioning right now, like, or those were okay. Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, like in my town, my brother is one of this like in this group, and my in other countryside where my wife from is my brother-in-law, he's doing that as well. It's going because now like there is a strict curfew from 7 p.m. until 7 in the morning.
Okay.
And like in the 7 in the morning until 7 p.m. only shops and bakery stores are allowed, and the local pharmacies are allowed to open, not anything else.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Is supported by our members and by Powell's Books, with 5 Portland area locations and an online store offering more than 2 million new, used, and out-of-print books. More information available online at powells.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Before we begin today's episode of Between the Covers, I want to remind everyone that we've had to cancel our usual spring membership drive because of the pandemic-induced station shutdown. So we hope you'll show your support by giving online at kboo.fm/give. We know times are tough, so if you're not able to donate, don't worry. But if you can at this time, please show your support for this free community resource at kboo.fm/give. Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Mexican novelist Fernanda Melchor. Melchor received a degree in journalism from Universidad Veracruzana, where she was coordinator of communication of the Veracruz del Rio campus, and she has a master's in aesthetics and art from the Benemérita Universidad Autónoma de Puebla. Her fiction and nonfiction has appeared in the Paris Review, Le Monde Diplomatique, GQ, Vanity Fair, and Replicante, among many others. She's the author of the essay collection Aquí No Es Miami and the novel Falsa Liebre, and in 2018 she won the Pen Mexico Award for Literary and Journalistic Excellence. Fernanda Melchor is here today to talk about her first novel to be translated into English, Hurricane Season, just out from New Directions and translated by Sophie Hughes. Fernanda Melchor won the 2019 Anna Segers Prize from the German translation of Hurricane Season, along with her translator Angelica Amar, joining past Between the Covers guests Cristina Rivera Garza and Yuri Herrera in earning this distinction. Hurricane Season has also won the International Literature Award and an English Pen Translates Award, and Fernanda Melchor and her translator Sophie Hughes are shortlisted for the 2020 International Booker Prize. Publishers Weekly says of Hurricane Season, "Melchor's English language debut is a furious vortex of voices that swirl around a murder in a provincial Mexican town. Forceful, frenzied, violent, and uncompromising, Melchor's depiction of a town ogling its own destruction is a powder keg that ignites on the first page and sustains its intense explosive heat until its final sentence." Ben Lerner adds, "Brutal, relentless, beautiful, fugal, Hurricane Season explores the violent mythologies of one Mexican village and reveals how they touch the global circuitry of capitalist greed. This is an inquiry into the sexual terrorism and terror of broken men. This is a work of both mystery and critique. Most recent fiction seems anemic by comparison." And finally, Jeremy Garber says, "Hurricane Season is an unrelenting torrent of violence, barbarity, recrimination, sex, greed, trauma, corruption, neglect, fear, lust, deceit, baseness, and the insidiousness of evil." The young Mexican author writes with unflinching ferocity, and her propulsive prose is simultaneously scintillating and suffocating. Hurricane Season brings to mind other darkly delirious works of semi-fiction like Rafael Chirbis's On the Edge, Bolaño's 2666, or even the novels of Santiago Gamboa. Inspired by a story Melchor encountered in a local newspaper, Hurricane Season offers a testimonial of our increasingly depraved age of disconnection and disposability, a remarkable, indelible work of art. Welcome to Between the Covers, Fernanda Melchor.
Hello, David. Hello, everyone.
So one of your books prior to Hurricane Season is a nonfiction book called Aquí No Es Miami, which will be called This Is Not Miami in its eventual English translation. That book is a series of true stories that are set in and around the city of Veracruz, where you grew up. And while Hurricane Season is fiction, the people in it feel similar to the real people in these more journalistic literary pieces that you wrote. The idea for Hurricane Season began itself with a real life event. And at first you wanted to write something in the spirit of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. So I was hoping maybe we could start with your encounter with the real life incident. What about that incident captured your imagination? And then ultimately, why you decided to write this as fiction rather than as another piece of nonfiction?
One of the things I found more interesting about this case, well, I don't know if I should call it a case. I read once in the newspaper around the year 2012, I think. I was working back then in Veracruz. I was, I studied journalism, but back then I did social communication, like for a university. So I was in my office reading the newspaper, and I found this story about a witch who was murdered in a small village outside in the outskirts of the port of Veracruz, where I was working and living. And one of the things that most impressed me was the fact that the policeman, the journalist, everyone in that small news story seemed to believe that witchcraft could be like a motive for a murder. So I thought that was really particular about a city. I thought that was something very particular about Veracruz. The spiritual beliefs in witchcraft and sorcery, and I was just trying to figure out what was behind that crime, you know, like if the killer said to the police, "I murdered her because she was doing witchcraft on me," I wanted to understand what actually had happened, you know, the story behind that story. And that was like you know, like a seed, like something was planted in my mind, like a curiosity to find out what really happened. And I don't know, I guess I was just trying to build a story from that kind of information. So it is always strange how fiction works, right? I mean, you go around, you know, living and working and doing your stuff, and sometimes you read something, somebody says something to you, or you hear a piece of a song, and something explodes in your head, and you find a story there. And what happened was that at first, as you told, at first I wanted to write a sort of a nonfiction novel, like In Cold Blood from Truman Capote, who was it is an author that I really, really respect, and one of the first authors that I read in my youth that made me realize it was possible to write about reality and write about fiction with equal quality, with a great level. And well, Truman Capote is a genius, a total genius, but I was not. So while I was tempted to go to this small village and start doing research and find the names and, you know, find everybody who could tell me something about this crime, I thought that it was not only dangerous at that time, because, you know, 2012 was a very difficult year for Veracruz. In that time, we have like the presence of two cartels, sometimes three, fighting their position, fighting the drug dealing business. And it was a very difficult time to be in Veracruz. And also, I didn't thought it was the best. I didn't thought that just by being there and asking questions to, you know, the murderers and getting into, you know, getting permission to interview them in jail and talking to the police and talking to the neighbors of the victim, I didn't thought that I could get to the heart of the crime. I wasn't sure I could do it. It is something weird when you think of the center of a crime, of the heart of a crime, what lays in there, and why would anybody would want to share that with another person, and stranger like me, stranger woman like me. So So I thought it was a bad idea from the beginning. So maybe I tried to console myself that I could do that research through fiction. I mean, to explore this awkward, dark feelings and emotions inside myself, thinking that at the end we're all human beings, and what happens to one of us is practically what could happen into anybody else. So I don't know, it was very different. For example, when I wrote Aquino's Miami, This Is Not Miami, lots of those stories were also stories I heard even when I was a little child, and that I was so curious that I grew up and was my way of finding the truth, you know, doing journalistic research, hemerographic research. And these dark stories about Veracruz, but at the same time I always thought that this story with the witch was going to be something different, not a nonfiction. I mean, I like to play with the idea to be a crime reporter, and I toyed with the idea of going there, but at the end I thought it was too dangerous.
What's interesting about reading your nonfiction in Aquino es Miami is that it often feels like you're reading fiction. And I don't mean that it feels unbelievable, but it feels like you draw us into a spell or into a scene that I often associate with reading novels. And you even have pieces that are written in the second person, even though you're telling a true tale. And there's this interesting meditation you have on this in your author's note to the nonfiction book, where you suggest that all language, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, doesn't really represent reality, but disturbs it. And you quote Sartre, who said, "It is not reality that tells stories, but human speech and memory." And similarly, in the epigraph, in one of the epigraphs to Hurricane Season from the novel The Dead Girls, it says, "Some of the events described here are real. All of the characters are invented." And I guess I wanted to hear a little bit about your thoughts on language and its relationship to quote-unquote reality.
Well, to be a journalist, I think I have like an extreme position to consider language totally far away from reality. This is like really hard sometimes to explain to colleagues, journalists, and I always try to. They ask me, "Why is that story real? But you're telling it like a tale," and I'm always interested in finding the best way to tell a story, to find a way that's, you know, not only fun but touching. I really believe that journalism in its search from objectivity, from total objectivity, it has lose its grasp on language. I think this happens in Mexican journalism. We have a genre called crónica. It's like literary reporting, like long form, like it's really hard to explain because it has become a genre of itself. So it is about telling a story with the using literature, like using high literature. And normally that would collide with the idea that words are simple and words are like unidimensional objects that can be used like utensils, like tools, right? But at the same time, I think words are difficult also, and they are they turn against you when you try to use them. And all what I wanted to do was to not take for granted this complex nature of words, and I wanted to use words in a way that could produce feelings in the reader or in the listener. What happened in that time in Mexico was that either the press was not talking about narco violence, or they were talking about it, but it was all about the great capos, you know, like the great kingpins, or the marina, or the police, or the government. There were like two big sides of one struggle. And the stories I wanted to tell was the stories of the ordinary people who had to suffer that violence. You know, that had to suffer the shooting machine guns in the streets, and innocent people getting kidnapped and disappear by thousands, hundreds of thousands of people disappearing in Mexico during that time. So I wanted to talk about the experience of regular people.
Is that a way you would distinguish hurricane season from the popular narco literature genre of Mexico? One way I see it is really different is that, I mean, you mentioned that it's not glorifying like the mythologies of these drug cartel leaders, but also none of these drug cartels are even in the book. Like we're really seeing the effect without seeing them present.
Yes, the thing is, in that time in Veracruz, there was like a split in society. There were lots of people who justified the violence of what was happening, the war between government and organized crime. They were trying to justify that by saying everyone who's a victim is because he did something bad. Every victim is because he was with the bad guys, you know? And I was trying to write these stories talking about how every one of us as a society had a sort of responsibility in the violence, even a small one, you know? But I also wanted to distance myself from the official narrative. And I wanted basically to write down stories that I was listening around me. And the thing in Veracruz is people, they have a really strong oral speech culture. You know, in Veracruz, to be popular, you have to tell jokes, no? You have to improvise poetry. It's called decimas. Everything has to be with verbal expression and you know, rhythm. And I think this has to be because of our multilingual and multicultural origins. Veracruz was a city that didn't exist before the Spaniards came to Mexico. It was founded by Spaniards and populated by indigenous people from Mexico. And also we have the presence of people all over the world and an important presence of an African root in Veracruz. So this kind of mix makes a culture that gives really, really great importance to speech. And that means that people are great storytellers, but nobody cares for writing those stories. So legends, stories, folk tales are very important in our culture, but at the same time, it is like an art that you practice by talking. So I wanted to write some stuff because memory is treacherous for us in Veracruz. So in the case of lots of anecdotes that I wrote down were present in my life since childhood, but nobody could tell me when actually that happened. So I had to go to the archives and the library and the hemeroteca, the hemeroteca, and search for the actual information. So in a way, it was like discovering where I was from and the stories where I was from. And at the other side, it was like training myself to be a writer, because at that time I wanted to be a writer, a novel writer. The novels are like the literary genre that I prefer over everything, I guess. I was a novel reader since a very early age, and it is just a literary form that I feel really passionate about. And I wanted to be a novel writer, a writer of novels, but the way for me to create, like, you know, literary muscle, like writing skills, was to, for me, I thought it was studying journalism and beginning by writing these nonfiction stories, because it was easier for me to find the best way to tell a story. If the story wasn't mine, if it was something that I could trace and search and investigate.
And because of this emphasis on the spoken versus the written, is there an absence of Veracruz in the Mexican imagination? Like, do we see Veracruz underrepresented in the literary imaginary in Mexico?
I think the disappearance of Veracruz imaginary is more recent, because, you know, Veracruz was a port founded by Spaniards, so it was a very important place at the beginning of Mexico's history and as a colony. We always joke and say that everything that's good and bad entered through Veracruz, because it was the only port that it exists in Mexico for a long time, and the most important. So through Mexico entered the Spaniards that end up conquering Ciudad de México, the old Tenochtitlan. So through Mexico came all the disease of the old world, for example, that took the lives of millions and of indigenous people. And through Veracruz, we got what we now in Mexico call our culture, or mix of beliefs and ideas, and this complex mix of different elements that now makes us Mexicans. Mm. And at the same time, there was lots of presence of Veracruz in the first chronicles, historical chronicles, or chronicles of traveling people, travelers who came to Mexico. Humboldt, for example, had to come through Veracruz, so he knew Veracruz pretty well. And there was lots of times that Veracruz was the center of historical events also. But what I think is now in contemporary literature, and I'm thinking from the beginning of the 20th century just to now, I think there's been a prevalence of the life of Mexico City in Mexican literature. Now you see it, for example, with authors like Carlos Fuentes or Roberto Bolaño, who's not Mexican, of course, but, well, he did his whole career, part of his career in Mexico, so I'm going to consider him a little bit Mexican. And they always talk about Ciudad de México, Mexico City. And Mexico City is this huge monster of a city, and it's super interesting on its own and totally worth writing about it. But I think between Mexico City and the north of Mexico, you know, like the border, who's given lots of stories about not only narco violence, but migrations and about the perks of the lives of the people who work and cross the border every day. So I guess Mexican literature has forgotten a little bit about the South. So I kind of thought it was necessary to talk about Veracruz. And what else could I also talk about one has to write about what is familiar to oneself.
What are you working on? What are you working on now, and what can we expect from you next?
I'm working on a new novel. I'm kind of polishing the final draft, and it's been a very interesting work. I cannot reveal much because that will make me feel really bad afterwards. I already know how that goes.
Well, let me ask you this, because I saw you on Twitter. You tweeted in Spanish, finished.
Terminé.
Yes, which suggests you finished a draft, I'm guessing, which perhaps you've unlocked the secret of how to write while we're under quarantine and a pandemic. So
I think it was a matter for mental health for me. So I was working in this draft from forever, from a year ago, and I really wanted to have it done. And what happened was that I was so focused in the draft that I totally leave out the COVID and quarantine and coronavirus and people dying. And I know it sounds terrible, but for me, it was a matter of survival, of surmounting anxiety. And now that I finished, it's like everything felt over me like a building, you know? It's I barely begin to manage all the losses that I'm facing this year, for example, due to coronavirus. So yeah, you can lock yourself up and write your asses off.
To stave off reality by continuing to produce more art.
Well, as I told you, I didn't have any choice. It was my way of dealing with the situation.